Good morning, we're the Historians. I'm Jay Sammons here with my longtime friend and Boston University colleague, Professor Brenda McConville.
Coming to you from the shadow of Bellevue Hill and the mystical banks of the electronic Charles.
How's the Charles look this morning? Is it freezing yet, Professor McConville?
The last time I was down there was no ice on it, but it did not look inviting as far as a swimming destination or a drinking destination.
Has it ever looked inviting for either one of those things in the last couple hundred years?
No.
Probably not. Well, what are you having for... Oh, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
It's our first show of 2022. Brendan?
Everything goes right. It'll be as grim as
our guests are speaking before we even introduce them.
Yeah, our guests are speaking. Yeah, they're trying to get in.
That's amazing. Yes, amazing. But behave yourself, eminent historians.
Historians, yes.
I'm behaving myself.
All right. I'm going to introduce the guests here in just a second because we have a very special show.
Listeners, the guests are rioting in the background. Right. We can't control them.
All right. But we just we'll offer them some breakfast. What are we going to offer our guests for breakfast this morning, Professor?
I am going to have some bagels. It's going to be a garlic bagel, some cranberry juice, and maybe some grapes to go along with that. As we know, I have grapes in almost every meal.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's a proper breakfast on some planet. But I'll just go with two eggs over easy with a sausage. And we will offer a breakfast buffet to our guests, right, which they can choose from fruits, bagels, eggs. They can have any kinds of meats they might approve of.
Tofu. Tofu. Vegan selections.
Right. So I should introduce our guests. We are extremely pleased today and honored to have two eminent historians joining us. We've never had eminent historians on the show, I don't think, before. Have we, Professor? No, we've had some.
We've had some, but not us. You know, that's all.
We don't qualify. So on this episode of The Historians, you'll have four historians, but two eminent historians.
Right.
First, Professor Robert Johnston, who is a professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago, who has a PhD from Rutgers University, which I believe is located in New Jersey, if I'm not mistaken. Well, I think you have some connection with that state, Brendan.
Yes, I do.
But even more dubious is his undergraduate degree, which is from Reed College.
Yes. I would note, listeners, that three of our four speakers today have Reed College connections. Two of us are graduates, and one of us is a former faculty member of Reed College.
That's right. Look, Professor Johnston is an extremely well-published historian. I'm just going to list a couple of his works. A book published by Princeton University Press in 2003, The Radical Middle Class, Populist Democracy, and the Question of Capitalism in Progressive Era, Portland, Oregon, right? It's still pretty progressive there, I think, from what I can see.
To a confused degree, I'd say, right?
Professor Johnston is also editor of The Politics of Healing, Histories of 20th Century North American Alternative Medicine, which may be relevant, I think, to the subject at hand today. Our other eminent guest is Professor Alan Rogers, who is professor of history emeritus at Boston College. He studied also on the West Coast. Keep that in mind, listeners, two West Coast educated historians here, with his bachelor's degree from the University of California at Santa Barbara and a PhD from the same institution, University of California at Santa Barbara. He taught at Boston College, which is just up Commonwealth Avenue from us here, Brendan. I will just provide you with a selection of his many publications. Murder and the Death Penalty in Massachusetts, published by UMass Press in 2008. And then The Child Cases, How America's Religious Exemption Laws Harm Children, published in 2014. That might also be relevant to our subject today. So welcome, Alan and Robert. Welcome to The Historians. We're really, really happy to have you here.
Totally delighted to be here. Thank you.
Although I
do not approve of any meats, I should say.
Okay.
You don't approve of meats, right? It's you're in the vegan quadrant of our show. You're in the vegan section. I would note before we begin that I as I was saying before we came on air, between the three, our three guests, Robert has known me for 41 years. My co-host, Professor Sammons, has known me for 36 years, and Professor Rogers has known me for about 20 years, thus creating 100 years of McConville experience in the studio. Yes. Wow. Yes.
It's the centennial McConville episode.
Well, right. It's the centennial McConville episode.
Right.
But we want to discuss today a topic which is both, as our listeners will know, we like to do sometimes episodes that speak to a current concern or a current issue or a current problem, but to give it historical depth and try to come to an understanding of it. And that issue is the volatile and sort of politically explosive issue, which has been in our press for the last 2.5 years of vaccination and anti-vaccination movements, and how we understand them and where it comes from and what it's connected for, connected to, where what its broader meaning is. And we've sort of been interested in this for a while and been talking sort of loosely about having a show on it. We wanted to come to that today.
I told Brendan before we started that I was going to make a little speech because, of course, the term anti-vax gets thrown around and used as a kind of catch-all in popular culture and in the media, and it's used to describe people who are opposed to vaccination in general, who are opposed to a particular vaccination, who are opposed to vaccination mandates. And so, I want to make it clear, even if that word came out of our mouths, that's not what we're trying to do. We don't want to lump people into a category and use terminology that's basically used to stigmatize. But there have been movements that opposed vaccination or imposition of vaccinations, et cetera, as a historical phenomenon, and it's potentially relevant to the world we live in today. So it's very much the kind of subject we like to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's what Jay just said is just really important because, as you noted, first of all, it's being used as a slur to address, you know, to label all kinds of different people who have different views about where we are in our present crises and sort of how we get to that crises. But also, I think it's important just to understand that there could be all kinds of different views about it and that we're looking at it as a historical issue. What is its historical roots? How do they change over time? What gives it, you know, his historical meaning? And I think in the end, perhaps discussing how important or how aware the current debate is, how informed it is by historical understanding of vaccination and different people who have questioned vaccination or resisted vaccination, how related they are.
The listeners should know that both of our guests are working on this subject right now,
right, or have researched on it in the past, right, and know about this, you know about that deep history, which, again, no matter what your views are about this, it's important to have this understanding so that you can make sense of the debates going on about what the political side of it, not the medical side, but the political and the social side of it, what its meaning is and where it comes from. So I wanted to get, and we always begin when we have guests to ask them about a little bit about their educational background and how they got interested in becoming professional, in the case of both of our guests, professional scholars. And maybe, Alan, you could speak first to that. How did you end up pursuing history as a career?
It's a story I've told a million times, but I'll give it a quick pass by. I was born in Hartford, Connecticut, and my father contracted asthma, and so when I was about 9 or 10 years old, we moved to California with the idea, at least in my father's head, the idea that the warm sun would help him with his asthma. It did a little bit, but the smog countered that.
Right.
And in fact, and so he died at a very young age. But there I was in California. Luckily, it turns out, because California, the University of California at the time that I was age and somewhat educated to go to the university, was free, essentially. Cool. And at one time, after about a couple of years, when I was considering going, I'm still in high school, the tuition at the University of California went all the way up to $250 a year. Right? I mean, unbelievable. And because I mean, I could make enough money on a summer job and have leftover money and pay the tuition. And that was the how I got through those years of college. So I was, and of course, when Reagan became governor of the state, that ended. I mean, the first thing he did when he took office was push the tuition up. By that time, I was out, and I was actually president of a faculty, system-wide faculty group who were not happy with Reagan's direction of the university and so on. So that was a little bit of...
How did you get to be a faculty member, though? Why did you pursue...
You left over that part.
Yeah, you left over the part where you become the historian.
Yeah. Well, I became a faculty member because after, you know, as I just go back to my father. How did I become an historian? Yes, I'll do that first, and then I'll go to faculty member. My father, as I admit, was a poor, hardworking man who had asthma, as I suggested, and he was orphaned at age 7 and therefore never had any education whatsoever. I mean, he learned to read and that was it. So every evening at the dining table, he would say to me, "So, Alan, what do you think about the situation in the Ukraine?" And I'd say, "What? What?" And so then he would read to me from some article that he was reading the papers, you know, blah, 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 so on, so on. So he used to do that all the time. So finally, one day down the road, I thought to myself, I'm going to get this guy, right? So, you know, I'm going to respond to some one of these questions and I'll show him, you know, what I know and what he doesn't know. And so that I did. And of course, it was only much later when I realized, of course, that's exactly what he wanted me to do. And that was the beginning of my interest in history. So when I went to the university, that was my choice of what I was going to do. And I was at the, when I got my undergraduate degree, I was encouraged to work on a PhD. And I thought, well, that sounds good. And so that's what I did. And that's...
Now, Robert, I think you were inspired by the fact that you were my classmate at Reed. Wasn't that it? I mean, Alan's story is very,
heartwarming.
Heartwarming. And yeah, Robert was basically... you know, frightened into it somehow by his his education alongside me.
Yeah, I had no other choice. Besides Brendan, there are a number of other PhDs who come out of our general cohort, not just our class, but people we took classes with at Reed. And it wasn't hugely because of that experience in college. Both Brendan and I had this utterly amazing professor, Richard Jones, who was just utterly captivating as a teacher. And I know a number of us have had that kind of experience where if we had not experienced somebody like that, we might have taken a very different route. I was flailing. I had no idea what to do kind of with my life after college. I just knew you had to go to college and then something might happen. And even then at Reed, you know, it's a very teaching oriented place and I am forever grateful for that. But I never thought that I could like be a researcher. But I didn't think I could do anything else. So I thought I may as well go to graduate school. And I ended up doing that and utterly loving it. Also finding a way to try to really blend scholarship and teaching as well.
Yeah. I mean, it is strange. Yeah. We're coming up on our first break. We're going to come back and talk about the roots of anti-vaccination, the various movements about it. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
Tresca Restaurant and Bar continues to be a favorite with diners that visit Boston's North End. Voted Best Italian Restaurant in the North End by Rewards Network, Open Table, and TripAdvisor users, Tresca offers authentic Italian and Mediterranean cuisine with unconditional hospitality. led by executive chef and co-owner Richard Ansara and NHL hockey legend Ray Bourque, Tresca combines the Italian tradition of hospitality with delicious cuisine that creates a memorable dining and cultural experience. Located in historic North End at 233 Hanover Street, Tresca Restaurant and Bar is open 7 days a week. For dinner reservations, call 617-742-8240 or visit our website at trescanorthend.com. That's 617-742-8240 or trescanorthend.com.
WNTN 1550 AM and WNTN.com.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. We have special guests today on this episode, Professor Alan Rogers and Professor Robert Johnston. We're talking about the history of anti-vaccination. Brendan, I'll turn over to you and let you continue the conversation.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to ask, and in our break, Robert was talking a little bit about, is how did you get interested in this as a subject of research? And maybe we could start with Robert and then turn to Alan a little bit and just talk about how you got interested in this subject, vaccination and the whole issue, inoculation of vaccination and resistance to it.
Well, yeah, sure.
Go ahead, Robert.
So it was definitely not handed to me on a silver plate, like my advisor said, this is something that would be valuable. In fact, I never encountered vaccination as a legitimate historical subject or a subject at all throughout my time as an undergraduate and my graduate coursework. So what happened was definitely a combination of both the personal and the scholarly coming together. I was working on this dissertation, which ultimately became this book that Jay mentioned, The Radical Middle Class, about direct democracy in Portland, Oregon, during the early 20th century, when the city was a real leader in direct democracy. And I was trying to figure out which kind of initiatives and referenda I would study, which would be the most interesting, tell me the most about the politics and society of the progressive era during that time. And at the same time, at home, I had a young child, and my wife and I were trying to figure out what to do with immunization. This child is now 33 years old. His name's Sandy. He's a transportation planner in none other than Boston.
Wow.
And at that point, you know, we were kind of reading some pretty countercultural stuff out there in Portland, Oregon. That's what we were inclined toward, and encountering some real dissent toward immunization. And so then I go to the, at home, that's what we study, Mothering Magazine. And then I head to the microfilm room, and I find that in 1916, Oregonians actually voted on whether or not to ban compulsory vaccination in the state. And I thought, what? Like, I had no idea anybody had ever looked at this kind of stuff in the past. Mm-hmm. And it turned out it was a huge controversy. And the state came within 400 votes of banning all compulsory vaccination. And in Portland, 55% of the voters wanted to ban compulsory vaccination. So after that, I was hooked, because it came together as something I was deeply interested in, both personally and now in terms of scholarship.
Wow.
How did you get onto it, Alan?
Essentially, through the book, The Child Cases, that you referred to earlier. Of course, was the argument that disease was mental. It was nothing other than the belief in your head that you were ill and so therefore needed care. But no, of course, the argument of the church was that if you thought about it properly, that would end whatever illness you thought you had, right? And so on. And I thought, and of course, the result of that for children was brutal. I mean, that is to say, the child cases refer to in a single year, 8 children died because their parents refused to give them any medical attention.
Did that include vaccination, including refusing to have the vaccination?
Yes, because all you had to do was think. You didn't have to get a shot at all. I mean, that was not necessary. Medicine was the enemy. Medicine made you dependent upon pills and shots and so on. And that was, a kind of ridiculous as far as what we're concerned, right?
People were all concerned.
So I want to go deeper and sort of ask a little bit for the sake of our listeners, when do you see this emerging in the English-speaking world? In other words, the questioning of vaccination. I mean, clearly, Robert was just mentioning, you're both mentioning, you know, cases that go back, you know, situations that go back, you know, over 100 years. When did this emerge? I mean, in early America, I see it really emerging at the beginning of the 18th century with inoculation. And I see it as an issue then. There is also earlier in 17th century England, there were questions about that, which sort of go closer to what Alan was mentioning, questions about medical treatment and interventions that sort of predate this and in some respects are related. But I see it on, I do see it as an early 18th century phenomenon as they come to grips with smallpox, which is the disease that they really fear. Is that what you're seeing in terms of, you know, your general reading in the background of it?
Yes. I was going to start off my little introduction on whatever it was that I was going to say had to do with Abigail Adams.
Right.
Right. And the, in 1776, while John is in Philadelphia doing, as we know, the attempt to create a new government and break with the United Kingdom, Abigail says, writes him a letter and says that, I'm going to take the four children to Dr. Boylston so that they can be inoculated. And then she added, I think it's my duty. And just as I read it, you know, a few days ago, I thought, I was struck by that. I mean, the idea that, you know, she realized it was dangerous. I mean, in fact, she used the word a couple of times in the letter that she wrote to John. She knew it was dangerous to do that, but she also knew you had to do that, right?
Well, I think, though, the issue, going back, which we'll talk about that, because I think Alan raises a huge issue. During the War of the American Revolution, there's a massive smallpox epidemic in North America, and many people die. But I think that it goes back to the efforts in the English-speaking world where they transmit ideas about inoculation from the Ottoman Empire and apparently from West Africa. And they introduced this, and of course, Cotton Mather is one of the key figures. That's around 1706, their original discussion about that. And there's almost immediately after that, if I'm recalling correctly, there's people who sort of violently resist those efforts at inoculation because inoculation was very dangerous, as Alan just suggested. People got really sick, and there was a percentage of people who died because of inoculation. It wasn't simply, you know, gee, you take this and then your arm is sore for a day and everything is fine. People, inoculation was quite dangerous because you were introducing a weaker form of the disease into the person. Yeah. What were you going to say, Robert?
Well, first, I'll just play off of Abigail Adams, which is that if anybody wants to see a really vividly, I think quite accurate representation of Abigail and her children getting inoculated, it's on HBO's John Adams series.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's really very valuable to just see kind of what the technology of the medicine was at that time. But indeed, Brendan, you're absolutely right. And I'm really wrestling with this right now in the first chapter of this book I'm writing about controversies over vaccination over the last 300 years in America. And indeed, I consider inoculation and vaccination as different, but very closely related in terms of the controversies they inspired over who got to control the body. Mm-hmm. And definitely in 1721, when Cotton Mather finally realized one of his dreams, which was to bring inoculation into Boston and into the Americas, it inspired huge popular opposition, including from people like James Franklin, Ben's brother, who was the publisher of the first kind of...
And writes against it. He writes against it repeatedly. I mean...
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, and yeah, I mean, it's a huge issue. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, no, and it led up, in fact, to an assassination attempt against Mather, where some unknown person threw a bomb through his window with a note that said, it didn't go off, which is why we know about this note. And it said, you know, Cotton Mather, you dog, you, I'll inoculate you with this pox, you know, kind of like.
Right. What happens at the time of the revolution, which is what Alan had brought up, which that epidemic is so central to everything, is there's a crisis in the American political and military command over, do we inoculate the army? because this epidemic is raging. And I had noted this before. There's a pretty decent, I'm not in love with that book. There's a book by Elizabeth Fenn, Pox Americana, which is about it. I'm not in love with that book, but I think it's an interesting take in a sense. But there's a huge crisis in the American military. And do we inoculate the army and risk some of them are going to get sick and die? So many of them are already weak. Or do we, you know, expose, if they're exposed to the, you know, the uninoculated are exposed to smallpox, you might have a 20% death rate on that, given the situation of the army, or better. So there, it becomes a huge, it's one of the first crises of the, you know, of the American, you know, military situation is, if we inoculate, will it help us in the long run stay in the field? And they have to come to terms with that. And it is Washington that ultimately says, yeah, we need to, we have to do this to at least to the core continental units, you know, to, we have to try to get them inoculated. And it's a crisis. I mean, it's not just something that, it's really at the core of the, at the nation's birth. But I would say that what Robert pointed out about the 1721 unrest, there was unrest again in the 1730s, I think, and then in the 1760s and 70s again in New England. Serious.
Gentlemen, you Americans, can we contextualize this a little bit as to what was going on in Europe and other places? Is this a reflection of movements that were happening elsewhere in the world?
That's a good question. In the Ottoman Empire, inoculation was used wide. There was widespread use. There was also some resistance to it in the subordinate peoples of that, but there was widespread usage of inoculation that, in fact, there's pretty good evidence, and maybe Robert could speak to this, but I've read that a number of the people in England, in the English-speaking world, get the idea for inoculation from the Ottoman Empire. And of course, Mather is famously supposed to have been informed about inoculation by his slave. Is that not correct? Am I not remembering that correctly?
Yeah, Onesimus in 1706, like you were saying. They were having a conversation, and that's really what inspired Mather to become intrigued enough by the issue that he would read the transactions of the Royal Scientific Societies and find out that, in fact, there was beginning to be transmission of the ideas from the Ottoman Empire. And not just the Ottoman Empire, but, you know,
some of the West African kingdoms were using it. Yeah, a form of inoculation.
Yeah. But the actual connection came from the ambassadors, the English's ambassador's wife, who wanted to protect her children from smallpox. And she found out about these practices and transmitted that information.
So the English speaking world on this side of the Atlantic wasn't behind the English-speaking world on the other side of the Atlantic. In fact, it might have been ahead in terms of use of inoculations. Is that right, Alan?
The first were in Boston, and then very soon after that same year, it started happening in London with trials of prisoners and poor people.
Yeah, right.
One thing I would ask, I mean, and I'd ask both of Robert and Alan, is do you find that the aversion to this, as Robert said, it's about control of what goes into your body and everything, but do you find that the aversion of this, even in the 18th century, do you see it situated in a kind of political libertarianism or a kind of spiritual, you know, the Bible says, you know, things work a certain way and we shouldn't do this, or is it situated in an understanding of science and how, you know, sort of enlightenment science and how it works? What is it rooted in intellectually, this resistance?
Well, certainly in the 18th century, it's rooted, I mean, to say Cotton Mather, right? I mean, it's the religious groups in Boston and New England in general, and I think also in Connecticut, rally behind the idea of vaccination, inoculation.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's a huge push, especially coming from someone as distinguished and well-known as Mather, right? So
our listeners, Cotton Mather was one of the leading preachers of late 17th and early 18th century New England and British, you know, English speaking America. He was a Calvinist preacher, a Congregationalist. He came from two extremely famous families of preachers that had been in New England since the Great Migration of Puritans here in the 1630s. Yeah. But Alan's point is so well taken that most of the ministry rallied behind Mather because he's such a leading figure in this throughout all those 18th century outbreaks of unrest.
But were there social or political lines along which you could trace this? Robert, I see you nodding your head.
Absolutely. No, and here I'm really intrigued because I'm trying to use a general interpretive model that emphasizes what we might see as populism that carries through in a lot of these controversies over vaccination from actually the early 18th century. The term wouldn't have been used then, up to the present. And I'm following here, though, a pretty traditional old interpretation of a historian, Perry Miller, arguably the most important historian ever of Puritan intellectual ideas in the Americas. And he wrote an amazing book in 1953, The New England Mind, From Colony to Province, where he actually argued that the inoculation crisis was both a manifestation of and a cause of a conflict between the ministerial elite and people who finally were beginning from the lower levels to be able to attack that kind of authority. And so since the ministers, as Alan said, were very uniformly behind inoculation, James Franklin and other people used that cause as a way to say, hey, we are just as smart as the ministers. The ministers are saying, hey, we tell you to get inoculated because we're the voices of God, and we have just as much intelligence as they do.
Yeah, I think that is very central, how it begins to create political cleavages and is expressed along lines of political and social cleavage in the society. There are other cleavages there, I think, that are also expressed, but I think Robert's point is really well taken. We are coming up on our second break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
Modern Greek cuisine worth the drive down the Cape. Estia in Falmouth and Mashpee. From our famous homemade bread and award-winning olive oil to authentic Greek specialties, delicious mezze, fresh seafood, grilled steaks and chops, award-winning grilled octopus, coal-fired pizza, and lamb you'll fall in love with. All served inside gorgeous surroundings with craft cocktails and fine wines. The Markantonis family welcomes you to Estia, Falmouth on Main Street and Mashpee at the Commons. EstiaCapeCod.com.
WNTN, Cambridge, Needham, Boston.
All right, we're back with the historians. We've got a special show today on the history of opposition to vaccination. Before we get back to that thrilling topic, we have to welcome back one of our previous historical sponsors, Brendan. I think it's appropriate for this show, Reformation Fitness. Now, Brendan, I know you care about your health and are always striving to stay in shape. Have you ever considered joining one of the new historically themed gyms like our previous historical sponsor, Reformation Fitness?
I'm just waiting for the epidemic to ebb before I leap right in.
All right. I know this could be touchy for you as a Catholic, you know, that you want to think hard about this. But, well, listen, launched in Wittenberg, Saxony in 1517, Reformation Fitness began as a physical counterpart to Martin Luther's challenge to papal and other ecclesiastical or spiritual indulgences. Indeed, Luther famously stated that he could never have had the strength to compose, much less post, all 95 of his theses if he had not spent at least 2 hours a day in isometric exercises and high-impact cardio. From Saxony, Reformation Fitness spread across Central and Western Europe, with particularly high concentrations of Reformed gyms arising in Switzerland and Holland, while Italy, Spain, and Paris resisted the movement staunchly. The Counter-Reformation Fitness movement actually began in Provence, where it ultimately became known as the Society of the Mediterranean Diet, and from which it spread to several Oxford colleges. In England, Henry VIII patronized but never actually visited the 6 Reformation Fitness centers constructed in and around London during his reign. The centers were vigorously opposed by Sir Thomas More, although he was rumored to have visited one center secretly since he seemed to be in top physical condition at the time of his martyrdom. At Reformation Fitness, all Pilates classes feature, of course, a reformer, and every membership comes with John Calvin's 5-point guarantee. Even if you are totally depraved, if you unconditionally elect to join, despite your limited body tone, you will find our program irresistible and persevere to join the saints in a paradise of good health. In other words, even with limited atonement, you can have complete health at Reformation Fitness. For more information, email Zwingli@reformfit.com.
Fitness, Calvin's 6-point of piety.
Wow, that's amazing that comes up right now, that particular sponsor. In the break, we learned that Jonathan Edwards actually died of inoculation.
Yeah.
Somehow there seems to be a connection here between Reformation, good health, and I don't know. Anyway.
Five and 15% of people got really sick, and a very significant number of those died of inoculation. Inoculation was dangerous, but it was less dangerous. Is that not right? Isn't the number around that, something like that? But it was less dangerous than actual smallpox, right?
Yeah, death rates seem to be around 1.5 to 2% for inoculation. 2%. And a lot of it depended on how it was administered.
How skillful the administration was, what was. But I think about 15% of people got really sick from it, although the death rate on that is lower. I did want to jump ahead a little.
I think Alan.
Go ahead, Alan. What do you want to say?
I was just going to say that two of the Adams's children, Abigail's children, were there in the whatever house they were using to administer the inoculation. Two of the children, one 8 and one 12, were there in the house from June, I don't know, early in June till the end of August, because the inoculation didn't take, and so it had to be repeated. And Abigail obviously was afraid that, you know, it wasn't going to work at all, or, you know, if it worked, it would be disastrous and that kind of thing. So it was not easy to undergo and to have a successful inoculation.
Right. No, you read these accounts of it. It's very harrowing, the whole process, harrowing. And that's interesting. I didn't know that they were there that long, but I've read other similar stories about other people. It would go on for months sometimes.
Yeah.
The one question I wanted to ask, though, is I wanted to sort of leap ahead into the area that Robert's researching in the second half of the 19th century and into the early 20th century, where he's done a lot of his research. What are those? When do those movements develop, and in what are they rooted in? Do they have any knowledge of this 18th century stuff, or how do they talk about what they're doing?
Yeah. There are a variety of roots to this. And I think the one that was most powerful as the movements begin to form in the late 19th century were immigrants who had come to America saying, I'm escaping this tyrannical government that can force me to do anything. And now I'm being forced to be vaccinated too. So that was very powerful. All kinds of riots throughout North America, especially actually in Montreal, but say in Milwaukee, a number of other cities. And then also you had what I found is very distinctive subcultures of vaccine dissidents, right? As Jay said at the beginning of the show, I'm a little concerned about using the term anti-vaccination overly broadly, but like Native Americans had very bad experiences with disease, to put it mildly, as well as consciously administered disease.
If you mean destroying your culture is a bad experience, yes, it's a very bad experience, right.
And so there were a number of Indians who wished avidly to be vaccinated, and there were many others who wished to resist that. The same thing with African Americans who, in the experience of enslavement, had to be vaccinated. That was part of the value of their body to their owners. And at the same time also felt that as a badge of American citizenship, they wished to be vaccinated. But the people I think who were key to the early 20th century in making the United States what one public health official called the least vaccinated of any civilized country at the time were actually, and he was empirically correct about this, were middle-class activists, reformers who believed very strongly in civil liberties and political freedom.
So it's a libertarian, it's a social and political libertarian movement to say, I have control over my body, you can't force me to take this, and I'm going to resist it, you know, by means of politics. Is that fair?
Yes, and meaning that I would say you definitely had that libertarian core in many times and places, but there was also a sense that the experts who were telling people what to do were imperfect, and that the people had the knowledge to shape, say, public health policies. And given what we know about medical malpractice over the course of the 20th century, ranging from forced sterilization to the Tuskegee experiments, there was a reason for this kind of suspicion.
And Robert, could we say, too, that that strain of, Brendan's calling it libertarianism, but that way of thinking about government in the world really cut across American society for the longest time. Now it seems to be somehow politicized that if you have this view, you're on one side and not on the other. But in fact, that strain of libertarianism, you can't really tie it down a lot of times in American history to the left or right, center. You can find it. It's just a part of, you know, the American political fabric. You think that's fair?
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think one of the books that really shows that most deeply is a wonderful book that I'd recommend by Elena Conis, C-O-N-I-S, called Vaccine Nation. She's a scholar at Berkeley. And she especially looks at the growth of vaccine opposition in the 60s and 70s and shows that, in fact, it was feminists and environmentalists who were arguing for women's autonomy over their bodies and environmentalists who were concerned about toxicity who really were just as important at fomenting vaccine resistance as were the kind of right-wing folks that we know more about today.
Yeah, but what I would say, and this builds on what Robert said when Jay was talking about his politicization, in the legacy media and in the mass media, it's talked about as a populist movement. But as a fact, as Robert just suggested here, and I wrote this down, I said, would it be fair to say that at this moment there are two core anti-vax strains, anti-vaccination, again, using that term perhaps crudely, I completely accept that. One is what I would call steak and beer anti-vaccination of right populism, and the other vegan and tofu anti-vaccination, California anti-vaccination of people in the middle class or even elites who are saying, I don't want myself or my children inoculated. And there's actually, that part is getting a kind of pass in our mass media because they have close ties to those groups. But in fact, that's also a tendency in the resistance to vaccination, including in the case of COVID. Is that not fair, or am I overstating that?
Well, I'll say, Brendan, I not to forestall our guests, but I don't think that's fair because I think there's a third strain, which was brought out very well by the article that was published by the paper by the MIT group, which identified a strain of very deeply scientifically minded people. In fact, the researchers were shocked by what they found, that there is a group that's not in the steak and beer group, as you described it, or the vegan group, but who believe that the science doesn't justify what's happening and who are quite well-read in the scientific literature.
I believe that too. I mean that group is out there, and I was saying it's a mass movement.
Oh, okay.
That there's mass movement, but that look, there are people there. But what I'm saying is, in our current circumstance, are what they saying, is it rooted in what occurred in the later 19th and 20th century? Is there a connection between those earlier movements and the unrest over them? And in fact, one thing I want to go back.
Wait. Let him answer that question. That's okay, a really good question.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, Alan, I've been talking a lot. Do you want to give that a try, especially since you're from Santa Barbara, which is not too far from the California vegan strain?
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I was thinking of Massachusetts and its initial 1855, where it mandates that all school children are inoculated, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, that speaks to the New England culture again, just as, you know, the Adams is part of it, as I suggested earlier. And then what's his name? Hennings Jacobson bolts and says, no, I'm not doing this, right? This is ridiculous, that kind of thing. Because after the school children were vaccinated, then it's the state passes another law saying this is something that we all have to do, kind of thing. And Jacobson bolts. He doesn't go for it. He and others say, you know, this is nonsense. I mean, so that dynamic, in other words, is going on right there in the heart, as it were, of vaccination in New England.
Were not the transcendentalists, some of them, opposed to vaccination as well? Maybe I'm just stating, I, for some reason, I believe that, and I may be completely confused. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know, but I do.
I know they were
about,
against doing their own laundry. I do know that.
Yeah, yes, but I would say that I am curious about that relationship of that 19th century and early 20th century populist and its connection going forward. We are coming up on the last break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
Philotimo Restaurant and Casino is Manchester's best Greek restaurant. Come in to enjoy our award-winning Greek food and play a game or two at our casino. We are a proud charitable gaming establishment with a portion of our casino proceeds going to help local Greek charities. Philotimo is conveniently located right off of Exit 1 on I-293.
just across from the Mall of New Hampshire. Come in for a meal, stay for a game, and enjoy the best Greek culture and hospitality in the area. Philotimo Restaurant and Casino, 1279 South Willow Street, Manchester, New Hampshire.
You're listening to WNTN 1550 AM and WNTN.com. Austin's hub for international radio and specialty programs.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. For information on the historians or any program on WNTN Global Echoes Radio, visit our website, WNTN1550AM.com, and you can reach us at therealhistorians@gmail.com. We've decided to continue into our fourth segment with our excellent guests, Professors Robert Johnston and Alan Rogers, both of whom are doing research on the history of anti-vaccination movements. In the break, Robert just mentioned how incredibly central Boston is to this story and how much of this story happens in and around Boston. So a lot of our listeners will probably find that fascinating.
I think that it is. It's not surprising in some ways that Boston is at the center of this, because Boston is an intellectual center. It's also been a theological center. It's also been a center of scientific.
Yeah, but isn't it enough? Isn't it enough already with Boston? I mean, as a guy from Arkansas, when does Arkansas figure into this story? I mean,
yes. Well, when I look for intellectual leadership, and I always think
snob.
Arkansas.
Snob. I come from New Jersey, let me remind you.
Yeah, where we manufacture the drugs that are taken by everyone in the vaccines. We don't actually produce them or think them up, but we just, you know, dump them into the water supply and everything out there.
Rest my case, listeners.
Ironically, given this the current way people think about politics, Arkansas does have a claim of being very pro-vaccine, which is that some of the people who were most instrumental in forming the modern governmental vaccine complex were Senator Dale Bumpers and Clinton when he was president. So.
Senator Dale Bumpers lived across the street from my parents.
No, you're kidding.
They'd take walks together.
Did they? They knew.
Of course, my parents are very connected politically. I mean, Brendan, you know that.
Right. That's interesting that you use that term, because listeners, we want to talk a little bit more and not break over to our feature this week in historical news because of the currency of this issue right now, of how important it is. And that phrase that Robert just used, the current political regime of vaccination. And by what do you really mean by that? If you could expand on that, Robert, and its relationship to the development of the regulatory state.
Mm-hmm. Well, so if I'm getting right kind of what you are asking there, and also which ties over with what you were asking before, is that the general media portrayal of vaccine opposition, anti-vaccinationists, is increasingly that they were like tied in with the hardest part of the hard right, including given that as we're recording, tomorrow is the anniversary of the insurrection, like people there were involved. There was cross-fertilization between the insurrectionists and anti-vaccinationists, right? So that seems to be something that indeed the liberal media can focus on with accuracy and also imbalance, right? Because there are so many other streams, as you were saying, of possible vaccine dissidents.
Right.
Please go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, go ahead, Alan.
I was just going to say, you notice how the percentage of people who have been vaccinated now in this era that we're living through is fixed. You know, it's 60%. That's it. It hasn't grown. It hasn't dropped down. Only 60%, in other words, of the American population have been
inoculated.
Vaccinated.
Or vaccinated, pardon me.
Yeah. I mean, you know, which is obviously that's what spurs the number of people who have contracted with the COVID. That struggle, in other words, is going on over a majority of the population.
No.
Robert was finishing a point. Okay, all right.
Go ahead, Robert. Finish that point.
No, again, playing off what Alan is saying is that I think we, in the sense that we can tell about issues of today in historical perspective. That's always a little dangerous. But it's very clear that vaccine issues have never become so polarized on a partisan basis. There have been very, very sharp polarities to vaccine debates. And in fact, that's part of what is so promising about talking about these things on the show, is to indicate that these things have gone throughout American history as a strong current for 300 years. But that said, in terms of it being Republican versus Democrat, that is really brand new, because the vaccine movements, especially coming out of the 1980s, were very careful to manage that left-right split. You would have green granola folks, and you would have hardline evangelical conservatives, and they would be together in the same movement, especially because they could crosstalk over mothers protecting their children. And it's, I think that's still there, but it's certainly not as readily apparent now, given the current politics.
The division is, I mean, it's bitter, and it is, the rhetoric of it is really...
I think it's reflective. I Robert, I really like hearing you say that you think that overlap is still there. I think it's there too. You never really see it talked about except in the person of somebody like Robert Kennedy Jr., you know, who is, of course, not identified with the right at all, but is on this, what might you might put on the right wing side of this. But I think it's reflective of a larger, I wonder what you guys think about this, a larger phenomenon in the society. And that is that opposition to government, which was largely the role of the left in the mid 20th century, has really, we've seen a 180 degree shift, so that the political left tends to be more likely to support government action, and the right to oppose it, which is just the opposite of what I grew up with, and I'm sure you guys did too. It's something I have a really hard time adjusting my mind to. When I think of, you know, the hippies and the way I thought about them as a kid and as a teenager, and now those guys tend to be on the other side. It's quite strange to me.
It has to do with institutional capture. In other words, people of that, what they call bourgeois bohemians or whatever you want to call that social tendency, more and more of those people are running institutions or have strong say in institutions. And so therefore they think, well, now the institutions are good because I have a say in it.
We run them.
So we run them, right. Yeah. And there's a strong element to that. And you can see that. And you can see it as a phenomenon of new media and some other aspects of industrialization, you know, industrial structures or in companies and the corporate world. And so there's more comfort with it. And it is true, I think, in this moment that the Republican Party, a certain faction or group in the Republican Party, has become the strongest anti-statist. Anti-big government, anti-big corporate America, they're the strongest voice against that in American politics. And the anti-vaccination thing is part of that group's identity. It plays a strong and central role. Would you agree with that or disagree?
Alan,
either one of you, Alan or Robert?
And there's a lot of pushback that comes when the cases go to court. In other words, the case of people who bring suit because their child is allegedly has a difficult time because he or she was vaccinated as a child. In other words, with the DPT kind of thing, you know, diphtheria, tort, not tort. that kind of, and the pushback is the government is doing this. The government is doing this. We don't get to say whether we want it or not. The government is pushing us, that kind of thing. So it's a whole anti-government, you know, it doesn't single out, at least in these times that I'm looking at, it doesn't single out a particular party or whatever. It's not that division, but it is the division of, you know, it's my decision, not the government's decision children vaccinated or whatever.
It's a defense of individual liberty, you know, as perceived by the person. The thing that I would say about that, I think really interesting about what Alan just said, though, is that the contemporary anti-vax movement, again, speaking that, using that as a general loose term, I want to be careful however you want to phrase that. And I do agree with Jay and Robert that you have to be careful in saying that, because there's a whole spectrum of behaviors there. Some people say, look, I got the vaccine myself, but I don't believe it should be forced on people. There's a whole, but its roots, the contemporary roots of that
are in the fear that the sort of standard childhood vaccinations were causing autism. And there was sort of a pseudo or a real scientific research into that question. And there were some claims made that weren't substantiated. My understanding is that they were not substantiated at all. But I'm that's speaking in a kind of general understanding. But the current roots of the anti-vaccination moment in regard to COVID seem to be rooted in a short-term historical phenomenon that developed in opposition to childhood standard vaccinations that contain mercury. Is that not correct? Or am I misremembering that?
I think that's part of it, but I think
part of it, yeah.
Yeah. However, I think you're right that there are actually moments of genuine continuity between these movements and then actual real disruption where people who are vaccine dissidents have no idea what happened kind of before.
Yeah.
My sense, though, is that it's really important to make sure that we're not just talking about science and medicine when we're talking about vaccine conflicts. We're talking about politics, too. And so you can, as you said, be completely pro immunization and
right.
believe that vaccines save lives and say that science doesn't matter when you're trying to deal with a matter of political theory about what kind of obligation an individual has to the state and what the state can do with the body. And those are, I think, very thorny issues of political theory.
Yeah, a perfect example of that is the way, people switch their position on these particular vaccines, depending on pre or post Trump, once Trump was out of office, a whole bunch of people who opposed the vaccine developed under Trump became pro the very same vaccine. And that's a remarkable phenomenon. But I just want to say, Brendan, on this autism thing, I've read fairly deeply into the literature on this. I have yet to see one of these people cite, vaccines were causing autism and therefore we should be opposed to this vaccine. In fact, the most common thing is to separate these vaccines from all previous vaccines.
Because of the RNA approach.
To try to draw a historical wall between these vaccines and previous vaccines and say that they are completely different.
That's interesting because, look, what do we know? I mean, again, I'm vaccinated and I'm happily vaccinated and happily boosted. I haven't grown bat wings yet or anything. Nothing bad has happened to me.
Well, you already had them, so you're not.
Yeah, I already had the bat wings, so right, it's not a problem, right? I mean, all the various things that can happen, it already happened. So, I do think that that's interesting that I wasn't aware of that, even though I would link them as you and Robert point out here, there are very real disruptions and separations in part because an RNA, the type of RNA vaccine-based vaccines that are now Moderna and Pfizer developed are unique. They are not linked. They are not the same sort of inoculation that people would get, vaccination would get in previous day. They're based on a different medical and technological approach. We are coming up on the end of the show, and the hour has just blown by as we have discussed the prevalence and the issue of vaccination. I really feel there's more to say, but
we're going to have our guests back for another show, Brendan. We only scratched the surface of this, if you don't mind putting it that way.
we've only begun the vaccination process of this issue. Exactly. But I do feel like there's more, a deeper issues to discuss and the linkages to other ideological structures. We are at the end of the show. I want to thank both of our guests
Absolutely.
For being a fabulous visitors. We'll be back soon. We're the historians.
I'm Jay Sammons. I'm here with my friend and longtime colleague, Professor Brendan McConville, and we're the historians.
Coming to you from the banks of the Charles River with all new episodes, Saturday mornings from 8 to 9
on WNTN Radio 1550 AM.
Hi, I'm Paul Roberts. Join me every Friday from 12 noon to 2 p.m. for The Echoes of Erin, the program that puts a smile on your face and a song in your heart. On WNTN 1550 AM and WNTN 1550...